Exertion number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, reel 9.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 9. Have you any further memories of the battle at Caputo, Mr. Hawksworth?
Well, I think I've just about covered the main facts, the more prominent parts as far as my memory is concerned, but there is one final thing. I remember that this was we were working under extreme pressure in this particular area at that time, and the medical officer, unofficially, was allowing the assistants to administer morphine injections to the most seriously wounded in order to alleviate their pain. This was not the usual practice and officially disallowed, but the situation proved to be so stressful that on this occasion the rules were waived. I was carrying a homemade belt fastened around my waist in order to carry the necessary syringes.
Did you mark the wounded? Yes. That had received morphine?
Yes, the standard practice at that time, as far as I recollect, was that if a person or a patient was administered a morphine injection, an identifiable mark had to be plainly registered on his body, and we used to put an M in some bright colour on his forehead, and to this extent we had a rubber stamp made.
You moved back to Buckbuck and received drafts there. Where were these coming from?
Yes, once in the area of Buckbuck, reinforcements started to arrive, which were badly needed, and the first and the biggest draft came from the Essex Regiment.
How did they take to moving out of their own regiment into another one?
I think that they were either... I don't quite know how to describe this. They didn't know what they were walking into. They joined the light infantry, which for a start was strange to them. Added to which, it was a Durham light infantry battalion from the north who spoke or almost a different language. But eventually, they integrated and became firm friends of the Geordies.
Were they suitable material, good material?
Definitely, yes. In fact, my best mate, for the rest of the war, right up to Van Afro, where I was wounded, came from the Essex draft, which survived the book.
When you're relieved from a fighting situation, out of the line and going to rest, what are the main priorities for any man?
Well, I think it's reorganisation or resettlement, whatever one like to call it. It's a battalion situation, and the usual routine as laid down is carried out. First of all, the arms and ammunition is of vital importance, and then the well-being of the men is considered, the physical fitness. Are there any people still suffering from battle weariness or shell shock, as it was known in those days? And, of course, equipment had to be replaced and brought up to fighting standard, both men material and fighting vehicles.
Initially, straight out of the action into a situation where of comparatively peacefulness, does tiredness, do you need sleep, or what is your first initial needs as a human being?
I think everyone felt the need for a bit of quietude, a bit of solitude, the word, and we were allowed the short time we were in this area to go down to the beach, which was not far away, and most people, having swam for a while, would sit on the beach and just do nothing.
What was the state of morale of yourselves and the rest of the battalion?
I think morale, although it had suffered a jolt, was still high. People had lost friends, as one will in a situation of this nature, but I think there was a feeling more of anger than disappointment. Lots of the people thought that they'd been led into a trap, although this is only their own considered opinion. But the morale, as far as I'm concerned, remained at a high level.
You see, that some considered they'd been led into a trap or difficult situation. Were they laying the blame at the battalion commander or higher up still?
No, I never heard, not once, any remark as far as the inefficiency of the battalion command was concerned, from the CO down to company level. If any complaints were made, verbally or otherwise, it was directed towards those buggers in Cairo.
Were the officers involved in particularly in those early days after the action, in raising morale in any way? Were they talking to the men? Were there speeches or written information to tell them that they'd done well, etc., etc.?
Oh, yes. Once we regrouped in later days, the company commanders would address the remainder of their companies and told them that they'd performed to the best of their ability, and one couldn't expect more than that. And those that had come out safely would be form the nucleus of the newly reinforced battalion.
Was leave offered as a prospective way of lifting morale?
Well, we were reminded that that leave situation was still in fashion, and once we'd got further back into the reserve areas, that would be reintroduced.
How important is the receipt of cigarettes, hot food, good food, beer in the morale-raising situation in the early days after an action?
I think the as far as the supply of soldiers' necessaries, beer and cigarettes take second importance to good food, and the people responsible saw to it that these items were forthcoming.
After Bugbuck, and you'd received your drafts, where did you go then?
Well, we moved back by road to Kantara on the canal zone. The Australian battalion came in and we moved off.
Where are we going to?
We were told we were going up to the border of between Palestine and Syria, to a village called Merjayoun.
This was involved with what action?
The Vichy French had been kicking up a fuss in Syria, the Vichy French army and the famous French Foreign Legion, one heard, and this created a lot of interest amongst the ranks. They'd heard a lot about the French Foreign Legion, not so much about the Vichy French, but they didn't have any time for the Vichy French either, because they were, as far as we were concerned, were turncoats. So it was some apprehension, possibly, but nevertheless, a certain amount of eagerness that the battalion moved forward to this new place.
Were you part of a brigade of other units in this phase of the battalion history?
Yes, I think I remember we were in a composite brigade consisting of a certain number of Czech soldiers. A few Australians who've been left behind, and ourselves.
Do you recall what happened to you there?
Well, the battalion headquarters was situated in the centre of Merjayoun village, and the rifle company is dispersed around about. Our regimental aid post was towards the rear, at the entrance to the village. And I remember one distinctive feature, the Chateau de Beaufort was on the left of the village on a high crag. I remember Jock Lees, our medical officer, reading us a short history about it.
Where were the enemy in relation to yourselves?
The Vichy French and the Legionnaires were into the Syrian countryside, facing us across the Litani River, which snaked its way down towards the Mediterranean Sea. One difficult aspect of the situation, operationally speaking, was that one approached Emerjoun from the Palestine side of the border had to pass through an area which had previously been used by the French gunners as a target ranging area, which meant that any movement along that road was subject to intense accurate fire.
Did you experience a lot of fire from French guns?
Well, yes. Our part of our jobs on the regimental aid post side was to proceed to the rear daily in order to bring up certain medical supplies from the field ambulance base. And in order to do this, we used battalion transport and ran the gauntlet on a regular basis. We never suffered any direct hits or casualties, I'm pleased to say.
Did the battalion suffer any casualties from this attention, from the guns?
No. Strangely enough, although the guns were in action occasionally, I would say infrequently, their accuracy seemed to have diminished somewhat because most of the shots incoming went over our heads into the field behind the village.
The terrain and over which you were moving and fighting, it had obviously changed from the desert. What was it like?
Well, it was beautiful. It was green. There were streams, there were gullies, there were mountains all around us. The climate was good. Generally speaking, it was quite a nice change, and everybody suffered well from it.
What happened to you next? You were placed in this village, and obviously you had to move towards the enemy or at the enemy. What happened to you?
Well, whilst we were there, the companies forward were sent out on reconnaissance patrols to gain contact with the enemy on the far side of the Litani River. And during one of these actions, coincidentally, Corporal MacDonald, who had previously been a colleague of mine in the regimental band, and later escaped with me from the Kos Island to Turkey, was actually captured by the Vichy French, who was later released when we occupied the town of Aleppo.
How had they treated him?
Badly. Apparently, he'd been handed over to some soldiers of a darker hue who took advantage of having under their command a British white soldier, and they let him know all about it. According to his personal report, he wasn't fairly treated at all.
Did the French put up much resistance as you went towards them, advanced towards them?
Well, there wasn't a set piece assault, as far as I remember. We were told one morning that there was a distinct possibility of the French signing an armistice. And so the battalion embossed in its transport moved forward to close to the border with a view to moving further on during the course of the day. And shortly after midday, we were moved further up into the Bekaa Valley and into bivouac areas along the road.
Was the supply situation for the unit good?
Oh, yes. Whilst in Emerjoun, we occupied the houses and outhouses belonging to the local farmers and itinerant villages, some of whom still remained. They made us very welcome, and there was plenty of food apart from the normal army rations, which we took advantage of.
Was there a strong anti-French feeling amongst the native people?
The local Arab population felt that the French had let them down badly.
How did the campaign go after this?
A stalemate developed. We realised that the war in Syria was at an end to all its intents and purposes, and we were later put into a bivouac area up in the mountains running up towards Beirut, from where various exercises were carried out. One interesting expedition, sponsored by Colonel Ardern, consisting of volunteers, were transported across the valley floor to the foot of Mount Hermon, with a view to climbing that mountain the following day. They also intended to contact the battalion on reaching the summit the following day by means of helio, which the signal volunteers carried along with them. The early hours in the morning from Fort Rachere, where we stayed overnight, this volunteer party commenced to scale the mountain, some from the proper mountainous side, others from the rear, where there was an accessible goat track. Colonel Ardern arrived second man, who was violently angry because one of the smallest men of the party, Signalman Sparrow, had narrowly beaten him to it. The helio was set up, and various messages were passed between our party and the battalion across the valley and the hills.
About what period of, what date would this be?
Oh, on the 21st of July, 1941.
Where did you go to after this? Was an armistice signed?
Yes, the armistice by this time had been signed, and the French had cleared out. As far as the Foreign Legion was concerned, we saw none of them. However, we were later moved to the north of Syria, and eventually into the town of Aleppo. We had a battalion position in Aleppo, and later part of the battalion were moved to a village near the Mediterranean coast called Idlib, not far from the Turkish border. There we spent 3 months in that part of the country, and on the 6th of October went south again towards Egypt.
What were you doing during those 3 months?
Resting mainly. We were entertained by concert parties provided by the NAFI and ENSA, whoever they were. Garrison Cinema, a mobile cinema, would come around and show films. So, generally speaking, apart from keeping our kit and equipment in good order, we were having a good rest.
Were you in the permanent camp?
No, we were all in civvy billets, odd houses, empty schools, and other deserted premises.
And the natives in this area, did you get on well with them? Or?
We saw little of the local population in Idlib. In the town of Aleppo, previously, of course, it was a bustling market town. We had no problems there. But as I say, we saw little and had little or no contact with the villagers in the village of Idlib.
In the October, you say you prepared to move out. Did you know where you were going?
No idea. We were told that we were going to relieve an Australian unit, and then that was anybody's guess. There were plenty of Aussies knocking about. But on 12th October, we were moved down to Alexandria, which left us in no doubt as to what our future destination may be. It was certainly a seaborne journey laying in wait for us.
Had you received any promotions up to now?
No, I was still a private soldier. I was still a stretcher bearer to all intents and purposes, but I was still kept on as the medical officer's batman, handyman.
The move to Tobruk, do you recall that?
Yes, that was an experience, a one-off experience as far as I'm concerned. We arrived at Alex and weren't hanging around very long before we were distributed and embarked upon various Royal Naval vessels on destroyers and I think one light cruiser, which set sail in the early afternoon along the coast bound for who knows where.
And the journey itself? Was it a quick journey?
The vessels on which we've been placed for this trip were amongst the fastest that the Navy could provide at that time, and by possibly 11 p.m. that night, we had not only reached the beleaguered port of Tobruk, but had been discharged, disembarked, and were on land.
What were your first impressions of Tobruk as you came to sight, sail, and got off it?
Well, having arrived in the dark, we were warned by the naval crew and our officers to be on the alert. It was a favourite spot for air raid at that time, of course. And The Navy, quite understandably, wanted us off, and they wanted out as quick as humanly possible.
Was the gunfiring going on? Could you see activity?
We could see on the land flashes, obviously coming from guns on either side. But generally speaking, the night we arrived and disembarked, it was reasonably quiet. There was certainly no air raid that night.
Where were you taken to?
We marched off carrying our kit bags up the road from the outskirts of the town of Tobruk into a large wadi, and where we were met by people from the Australian battalion who we were about to relieve, who made us welcome and provided us with a hot meal.
The positions that you relieved the Australians in, where were those?
Well, after we'd been in the wadi where we were placed on arrival, after about a week later, we were moved into a reserve position called the Blue Line in order to establish ourselves, have a good look around and realise just what it was all about. We soon learnt that any movement during the day without careful concealment would be noticed from some point along the opposite side of our perimeter, and one had to be extremely careful, particularly with vehicles. The few tanks that we still had in serviceable in the Tobruk garrison were carefully nursed and moved very rarely during the day.
What was the terrain like that in which you were, and where were the Germans? Where were their positions?
There was a semicircle of defences around the Tobruk area, reaching out possibly 3 or 4 miles in some places. On the 9th of November, we were put into our first permanent position on the front line, which was known as the southern sector. And from that time on, patrols were sent out, not necessarily as a reconnoitring unit, but to learn the lie of the land, so that in future activities such as fighting patrol, etc., they would know just what it was all about. The terrain, generally speaking, was crisscrossed with dry wadis. It was extremely rocky, as far as I remember, and there was very little. In fact, I was about to say there was very little forestation. In fact, there was none. I can't remember seeing a tree around the Tobruk perimeter during the time I was there.
Were the Germans overlooking you, or were they at the same level?
The Germans could see our position from a distance. One particular area, the one I remember the best, was the El Adam sector, which was about in the centre of the ring, defensive ring, facing towards the El Adam Drome. The ever-present escarpment ran along in the distance upon which the main German positions were situated. And so from that position, although quite distant, our movements could be observed and communicated to their forward units. However, interspersed by some hundreds of yards around our perimeter, the Royal Engineers of some army had constructed observation towers which rose something like 30, 40 feet out of the ground, much to our amazement, from which harebrained forward observation officers supplied by the Royal Artillery would cast an envious eye upon the Germans, occasionally lobbing a shell at them.
Were these towers made of wood?
The towers were on tubular steel scaffolding, such as our builders use these days, with a flimsy tin roof, for whatever reason one can only guess. They were a favourite target for the German gunners, possibly training their recruits. And their favourite occupation at odd times by the Germans would be to fire shrapnel shells, trying to explode above these lookout towers with a view to penetrating the skulls of the officers therein.
What made up the Tobruk defensive lines, Mr. Hawksworth?
Well, as one can imagine, it had not long been a permanent situation. The withdrawal into the Tobruk perimeter and the final closure of the line had left little time to prepare a proper defensive position situation. However, there was what I would call a broken line around the perimeter, consisting of some concrete lined fire positions, some slit trenches. There were certainly some bunkers being constructed so that men could rest under cover from shell fire and small arms fire. At other places, there was just a gap between the connecting company, with possibly a shallow crawl trench adjoining. But generally speaking, it was a hodgepodge of hastily constructed holes in the ground from which the rifle companies were required to operate. The transport or delivery of food, ammunition and other necessary supplies was obviously a risky business, which was obviously done under cover of darkness, but it was successfully carried out from day to day, and people managed to get used to the routine. It was very much a nighttime existence, very little mood during the day, apart from the occasional Stuka raid, which by this time we'd all been accustomed.
Those initial raids of Stukas, what was their initial effect upon you before you experienced them?
I've never been so frightened in my life. Most people now knows what a Ju-87 looks like, but you've got to be underneath the actual aircraft whizzing down towards you before you can really appreciate how terrifying it is. The scream of the aircraft and the size of the noggin slung beneath it are clearly visible before it's released from the airplane. We were told by the Aussies before they left that they were sitting ducks at the bottom of the dive, but I never saw to this day one sitting duck shot down.
Was the positions wired in?
There was extensive wiring carried out and extensive maintenance of the wire fences and defensive positions in front of the perimeter. The perimeter proper, of course, was some distance behind the main wire fence, in front of which were further wire obstacles, and mine panels had been laid in the customary fashion in order to cover obvious lines of approach, such as hidden wadis and small hillocks. Machine gun posts were constantly manned, both day and night, by the sentries, and the brens were set up on the fixed line system so that an immediate alert would have the gunner on the ball and firing in the proper direction.
You mentioned mined panels. Can you describe those?
Well, a mine field, as they are commonly called, consists of a series of panels. Mine fields are placed in the ground in order to determine the line of approach which the enemy is likely to take. Once he knows or discovers mines, he'll do his best to avoid them. Therefore, gaps are left between each panel in order to encourage the advancing enemy to drive down this lane, presenting a good target.
Where was your own personal position in this system?
Well, our regimental aid post in Tobruk, in this particular sector, was situated some possible mile to the rear of the forward companies, battalion quarters with the commanding officer and his staff officers, and our regimental aid post was in the same vicinity. We had one or two rough-hewn homemade caves in the area, which we used as shelter occasionally, but usually we slept out in the open at night, covered by ground sheets and blankets.
The company battalion cooks, were they still presenting hot meals for you, although they were coming up at night?
Yes, one of the features about our battalion, which went through the whole of the war, the fact that whenever possible and wherever possible, our food was fresh and properly prepared, and there were always suitable cooks on hand to produce it.